What's the easiest choice you can make? Window instead of middle seat? Picking a vendor who sends a great gift basket? Outsourcing business tasks you hate? What about selling with Shopify? Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real-life store stage, all the way to the did-we-just-hit-a-million-orders stage, Shopify's there to help you grow. Whether you're selling scented soap or offering outdoor outfits, Shopify helps you sell. Wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify's got you covered. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/try. Go to shopify.com/try now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. Shopify.com/try.
This is a podcast from Minute Media.
Hello, and welcome to the Over and Back Classic NBA Podcast. I am Jason, and with me as usual is my friend Rich. Hello, Rich.
Hello.
How are things?
Things are pretty good. Things are pretty good. Nice. Yeah, life's doing okay, I guess. All things considered, yeah. It's
right.
It's fine.
Is the pandemic done yet?
No.
Somehow no.
Weird. Okay. It's not.
You would think
it would, but no.
Yeah.
It's not. But
everyone got vaccinated, right?
So yes. Like a problem. Yeah. Everybody, yeah. But those who could not get vaccinated because they had immunocompromised. But yes, everybody else made the right decision and got vaccinated.
Right. Yeah. So. Yeah, they didn't take horse medicine. They just got
invested. Right,
Yeah.
Huh, but all things considered, yeah, it's going pretty good. And there's some fun basketball stuff going. We had a really fun offseason, I would say, and into a pretty fun season. So I'm excited. Yeah, the NBA is a lot of fun right now. So
should be a good season. Yeah, we'll see. Yeah, we've had some. The off season is almost like its own season now. You know, but it wasn't like that for a long time in NBA history. You know, this free agency, I mean, it didn't really exist in any kind of significant form until the late 70s. And then it took a long time for there to really be like, this derby of free agents. It was almost, really until like the late 90s, early 2000s, where free agency became, there was significant player movement where the league, a third or a fourth or half the league is, getting transitioned into a season. Before then, it was extremely rare. So we thought it'd be kind of cool to look back at the quaint early days of NBA free agency.
Yeah, we're going to do a little bit of the basic history of free agency and then a little bit of those early off seasons where finally the NBA says, all right, you guys want free agency? You got free agency. But then, nobody really moves or, some people move here or there or, the rules that are in place are much, much different. I mean, we'll talk about that now, in a bit. But yeah, the days, like you said, of a third of the league or half the league just up and moving teams every single offseason, that was not the case. There is years that have like four people that change teams or four different free agent signings. So yeah, it is nothing like it is today. And it would take many, many, many years. I mean, in our lifetimes even. For free agents. I mean, there are years in both of our lives and in both of our NBA fandoms and most people that are listening to NBA fandoms that there was nothing happening in free agency. I mean, it is a very relatively new thing that all of a sudden it's just this giant bonanza for a month and a half where everybody's changing, everyone's moving, everyone's doing stuff. Like that just was not the case for a lot of NBA history.
Absolutely. So, I mean, basically, free agency comes to the NBA in 1976 as part of the settlement of the Oscar Robertson lawsuit. There were a few instances of it before 76, 77, and we'll talk about those. But, it really comes to the league for them. Before then, there's the reserve clause. Basically, a team has, the only way that a player can leave the team is, if the team basically doesn't want him anymore. That there's a few exceptions to that, but that's pretty much what happens for the most part. Of course, the ABA comes in the late 60s, and suddenly there's a bit of player movement, guys switching leagues, and, that adds a little bit of the player freedom, but, it doesn't really take off until the late 70s. And even then, it's much more limited form, as we said, than today. But so, Oscar Robertson had a quote, his advice to NBA free agents: Take advantage of it. You only come this way once. When it's gone, it's gone. You're not going to be able to come back and play anymore. So, and it began class action antitrust suits filed against the NBA and its teams in 1970. Oscar Robertson was president of the NBA Players Association, and the reps from the other 13 franchises at the time. He was with the Royals. There were 14 teams total. They were co-plaintiffs. And he had been the union president since 1965. He was the first African-American president of any national sports or entertainment labor union. And then, 1970s.
Not to interrupt, I did find it ironic that Bob Cousy in 1954 was the first president of the labor union. I would assume that his take on unions is changed a lot in recent history, I would assume, given his other political affiliations. But maybe not. You can twist yourself into pretzels for a certain person some these days.
People are not always consistent.
No, I live my life with people that I'm like, but you're in a union. Okay, all right.
But you're literally
in a union. Right. Okay, all right.
Doesn't make sense. Yeah. Huh,
but this guy and you're... Okay, all right.
Yeah. Whatever. Take that horse tranquilizer. See how that goes. Yeah.
Not horse tranquilizer.
Oh no, I'm sorry, horse. Well, maybe tranquilizer. I might help. Yeah.
That is not my official stance, but okay. I mean,
fair enough. not endorsed by both members of the Overback podcast.
Jason,
just what? Right.
It's expressed here. Take horse tranquilizer.
Yeah. Hey, take a lot of it. Yeah.
Jason.
Man. Yeah. I would say.
I mean, I don't disagree, but officially, as half of this for future. Advertisements and representation. I do not officially endorse Jason Stans.
Right. Way to go. All right, Rich.
I am a sellout. Yes, that is me.
Way to keep the business alive.
We would not make a good union because I just threw you right under the bus there. So
that's true. You would be a scab. Yeah.
I would be a scab.
That's really sad. Yeah. It's disappointing.
Dr. Curtis Harris and Rich Grage, the new over and back.
Well, that'd be an upgrade. I understand that. So,
although I don't know if he would probably agree more with you. So I guess.
Fair enough. Anyway, 1976, the league, now 18 teams. There's a class action set up with the Players Association. This also goes hand in hand with the merger of the ABA. It basically eliminated the option or reserve clause in the NBA's player contract, no longer binding a player to one team for life, basically. First step toward unrestricted free agency in the NBA. Basically, what happened, and this is from 1977 through 1980, the primary part we're going to talk about, is teams now had the right of first refusal on any contract offered to their own players. Then if a team chose to let a player walk, the original team was granted compensation. Either it would be a trade between the two teams that they would agree to, or the commissioner would decide it if the sides could not agree. And a lot of interesting decisions made by the commissioner going on. After the 1980 season, the rules were changed where it was more like modern restricted free agency, where players could sign an offer sheet with another team, and it could either be matched or not, and compensation was no longer automatic. And that lasted until unrestricted free agency comes in 1988 with the Tom Chambers contract. So, So that is the premise of the show. But before we get into that, we have a message from our sponsor.
Yes. Attention listeners across the galaxy, all the way from Australia to Houston, Texas. We have a pube problem. Or do we?
Do we?
We don't. Because our friends at Manscaped have cleared you for takeoff with their fourth generation and brand new Lawnmower 4.0. Kick your pubes to the next planet with the Performance Package 4.0. The orbits in your pants will feel like you're in zero gravity when you use the best tools for the job. From the leaders in male grooming, join the 2 million men worldwide who trust Manscaped and get your rocket ready for takeoff. I cannot believe I had to say that. Get your rocket ready for takeoff, Jason, by going to manscaped.com for 20% off plus free shipping with a code FANSIDED20. Again, manscaped.com, 20% off plus free shipping with the code FANSIDED20. You want to tell me a little bit about this Performance Package 4.0?
Absolutely. And whether it's your Houston Rocket, it's your Denver Rocket, it's your San Antonio Rocket, are you ready for an out-of-world experience? Look no further than the Performance Package 4.0 from Manscaped, taking off not only the USA, but Canada, the UK, across Europe, Australia, South Africa, and Singapore.
That's crazy. Inside, I mean, we have listeners all over the place. We're big in these, especially in the smaller countries that have, like, you know, 1,000 people. We're big in those countries. Let me tell you,
we're huge. Yeah, absolutely.
We are undoubtedly the number one NBA history podcast on a lot of very small islands. Corsica, we kill it in Corsica.
We absolutely murder in Corsica. We're huge celebrities in Corsica. So it's wonderful. Yes, and inside the package, you're going to find the Lawnmower 4.0 trimmer, the Weed Whacker ear and nose hair trimmer, the Crop Preserver Ball Deodorant, the Crop Reviver Toner, Performance Boxer Briefs, and a travel bag to hold your whole solar system.
There you go. So first scheduled for liftoff, the new Lawnmower 4.0 trimmer. This spaceship is here to guide you on a journey to trim your body, your balls, your butt, and even Uranus. This fourth-generation trimmer also features cutting-edge ceramic blade to reduce grooming accidents thanks to their advanced skin-safe technology. The Lawnmower 4.0 has a 7,000 RPM motor, a new multifunction on-off switch that can engage a travel lock as well. Best of all, it is waterproof. Lastly, the Lawnmower 4.0 has a 4,000K LED spotlight that you can turn on and off when needed for a more precise shave throughout your travels across the universe.
The Performance Package 4.0 also includes the Weed Whacker. It's like having a little astronaut to chop your worst weeds up top in your nose and ear. And the Weed Whacker, it's also waterproof, and it uses a 9,000 RPM motor-powered 360-degree rotary dual-blade system. This nose and ear hair trim provides proprietary skin-safe technology, which helps prevent nicks, snags, and tucks in those delicate holes. Do not forget to use the Crop Preserver Ball Deodorant and their Crop Reviver to help your little planets be on their A game while feeling the sun's heat. Fans can even throw these two free. Absolutely.
Fantastic. So abort hairy balls and Buzz Lightyear that Woody with Manscaped. Again, 20% off plus free shipping with the code. That is pretty.
You nailed that one.
is a lot. 20% off plus free shipping with the code fansided20 at manscaped.com. Again, 20% off plus free shipping with the code fansided20 at manscaped.com for a clean Trinity and beyond. Your space balls will thank you. 20% off plus free shipping. Code fansided20 at manscaped.com. That was a ride.
I'm going to tell you, I think you managed to preserve your dignity through that. So,
thank you. There's not much left to preserve, so I'm glad.
Well, that's good. Yeah.
It's waning every day.
So. Yeah, I mean, we've been together 8 years, so you know, I understand. You know, it's all good. So, as we talked about, summer '77, kind of the first real summer of any kind of free agency in the NBA. A couple notable ones that happened before then. So. First one is Cassie Russell. There was free agency with competition did exist, but it hadn't really been tested. You know, part of it is that like teams weren't really sure, like, okay, if I lose a player, what kind of competition am I going to get? And Cassie Russell was kind of the first significant test case. You know, this is 1974, signs with the Lakers. The Warriors did not offer him a no cut contract. He's 30 at this point, but he's actually still a pretty good player. You know, he's averaging more than 20 points per game. Golden State was a solid team. They would actually end up being a really good team the year after Cassie left. But then there's an interesting article from when it happens from the New York Times where it says that it's the first time in the league's history that a player had finished his option year, become a free agent. And then it says, since there is no precedent, it is not known whether the Lakers must compensate Golden State because they signed Russell. So crazy that they don't even know. Eventually it is determined, yes, they are going to be awarded compensation. They get the Lakers' eventual top pick in the 1976 draft, 2 years after this. And that pick ends up being Robert Parrish.
Not bad.
Yeah.
Not bad. But yeah, it's such a bizarre thing because there's probably younger listeners that are wondering, like, why? Because nowadays, a lot of teams are like, great, cool, this free agent left. Now we have cap space. Now we can play our young players. Oh, we just drafted a guy at his position. Good, get him out of here. Like, get that old guy out of here. Let's, because in today's league, if a 30-year-old Cassie Russell wanted to leave, most teams would probably say, sure, go. We don't want to pay you. You're 30. We'll get somebody else. We have draft picks, all this sort of stuff. But in this days, it's like, well, oh my God, what are we supposed to? We need compensation. We lost this player from our team. What are we supposed to do? And it's just so hard to believe because, yeah, it's so different nowadays where, like, a lot of guys are just like, good, go, get out of here.
Right.
Great. If we want you, we want you. We don't want you. Go ahead, man. Just go anywhere. Go do whatever you need to do. So, but, yeah, it's not the case here. It is very much like, okay, well, we lost this player, so we must be compensated by the team that acquired that player from us type thing. It's very strange. But
when
you have the reserve clause and technically these players are, quote-unquote, you know, property of you, like, you know, that other team has your property now, so you want something back for it. It's pretty vile when you honestly think about it. It's just so weird because, yeah, to them, it's like Golden State's like, well, Cassie Russell is ours, and he can never leave. And then he left. So, no, you must give us something for that. It's just, you know, it's just absolutely wild. But, yeah, Robert Parrish, not bad compensation.
No, I mean, it worked out pretty well.
There's going to be if you want a theme for the show, is that the compensations are, like, really good.
Right.
And that the NBA should, the lower level teams in the NBA should really hold out for compensation for free agent signings moving forward. So,
Maybe it's going to come back. You never know.
Yeah. Right? Who knows?
Yeah. who knows? Maybe. Yes. Our second exception, Gail Goodrich. So, Goodrich, he held out in the fall of 1975, missed the first four games while playing out his option to become a free agent the following season. Was, you know, in a pretty bitter contract dispute with the Lakers at this point. Lakers said, you know, they were known for some bad contract dispute. Jerry West also had a similar issue with Jack Hankook, the Lakers owner, before he ended up retiring. And there was this lawsuit with the team. Goodrich eventually comes back. He plays with Kareem Abdul-Jabbar, who had just been acquired by the Lakers. Team actually missed the playoffs, going 40-42 in Kareem's first year with the team because they didn't have anybody particularly good other than Kareem Abdul-Jabbar, it turned out. Goodrich, was a good player but was definitely fading at this point. And then the New Orleans Jazz are like, hey, you know what? He might be 32 years old. We're going to take a shot at him anyway. So August 6, 1976, the Jazz sign a three-year deal with Goodrich, reportedly worth $1.4 million. Going to team in the backcourt with Pete Maravich. And, didn't go great. Goodrich, unfortunately, ends up hurting his Achilles in his first season, never really quite recovers. He's out of the league for 3 years. So short term, it's not great, although the Jazz end up being pretty good the next year. They do get some other free agents, which we'll talk about in a bit. Unfortunately, a couple things. First, in January 77, Goodrich ended up suing the Lakers, saying that he was shorted $150,000 of his $275,000 salary, so more than half of his salary because of fines, because of missing training camp. Also asked for $75,000 in punitive damages, saying that the fines were a breach of contract. So you talk about compensation and a team's like ending, holding out and getting a good compensation. Well,
yeah, might be the all-timer here. So anyway, so Goodrich signs with the Jazz in 1976 and the Lakers are saying, hey, well, you took Goodrich from us, so we want some compensation. Yeah. It takes a while to kind of get to the table to figure out what they're going to do. So the Lakers and the Jazz agree eventually to send New Orleans's regular first-round pick from the 1979 draft to Los Angeles, along with first-round picks in 1977 and 1978, and an additional second-round pick. I wonder if you maybe gave them too much.
Maybe a little bit, yeah.
Well, when you find out the names. So anyway, the Jazz are like, look, we're going to be great. We have Gail Goodrich and Pete Maravich. Take all our draft picks. We're not going to need them. Like, we're going to be a tremendous team. It's Gail Goodrich and it's Pete Maravich. Like, this is going to go great. The Jazz, unfortunately, finished the 1979 season with the worst record in the NBA. The Lakers are good. The Lakers are so
they're pretty good.
They're pretty good. But anyway,
not great, but not great. Good,
But so they're eligible for one of the top two picks in the draft. So if you're an astute listener over and back, if you're astute, about NBA history, that until 1985, the top two teams with the worst records flipped a coin to determine which team would receive the top pick. This was the Lakers versus the Chicago Bulls. Who is going to get the top pick? Coin flip. The Lakers win the coin flip, and they select little-known point guard out of Michigan State, Irvin Johnson.
Having
a decent NBA career, I would say, Jason. So, this is the all-timer. This is the when people talk about compensation and the weirdness of it, this is the all-timer here. And I guess I could see it from the Jazz's perspective, but I wonder if they maybe just gave a little too much. in competition. You already had the guy, you know what I mean? Like, you don't have
to. I think the commissioner weighs in on this one, or there's certainly pressure to come to it in accord here. I don't think people were just like, take our picks.
The New Orleans Jazz. They were pretty dumb. So that's,
they traded a lot of good draft picks. Yeah. So not great. Yeah. So, but by the way, all of our Corsican listeners knew, you know, they knew
we were getting.
Very astute. They totally know.
They know what they're talking about. So, anyway, Lakers get Magic Johnson. The Jazz get like 3 years of subpar Gail Goodrich. I think the Lakers won that deal.
I think officially,
in 2021, we can declare that the Lakers have won that deal.
I think it's been enough time. I agree. I think, you know, the facts are, I think we're the first to actually really make that judgment.
You have to give time. You have to see how, you know, the franchises play out and the ramifications. Sure. And I think now we can officially, all these years later, 40 years later, declare that the Lakers did win that pick. They may have won it, 8 months after that, like literally a year after this thing happened. I think they had already won it when, you know, Magic Johnson's holding up the Larry O'Brien trophy. So
we're just a hot take, but I respect it.
Yeah, thank you. Yeah, that's what we do here. So,
all right, cool. So 1977. Now we're going to start to see some player movement. Definitely limited, but we're going to see some really key players move along. The first one is Jamal Wilkes signing with the Los Angeles Lakers. Ends up, the Warriors end up getting Purvis Short, 1978 first round pick that ends up being Purvis Short, and cash going to the Warriors. So, I mean, the Warriors, Wilkes had only been in the league for 3 years. They'd won the championship in 75. They were still competitive in 77. But that would not last long. Unfortunately, the Warriors would not make the playoffs for 10 years after losing Wilkes until 87. Purvis Short, I believe, still on the team at that point. So they did, you know, Purvis Short, not too bad. So they did manage to get, you know, something out of that. But, yeah, you probably would rather have Jamal Wilkes than Purvis Short overall. And, yeah, I mean, Wilkes ends up, you know, coming to the Lakers. They've managed to collect some talent. You know, they've got Kareem Abdul-Jabbar, of course. They've managed to get Adrian Dantley. James Edwards, they're coached by Jerry West. So solid team, 77 season. They'd actually, they had the best record in the league. They ended up losing the playoffs to the Blazers, but, you know, they were a really good team. Seemed like they could be a championship contender. You know, things don't necessarily go super great for the Lakers, although they're still fairly good. But as you mentioned, you know, they got some draft picks coming in and, you know, hey, things end up going pretty well. They get Magic Johnson and things go well, but, you know, Wilkes really, maybe a little bit of an underrated factor in, you know, those championship teams.
Yeah, no, he, in that 1980 season, Wilkes is the second leading scorer on the team. I mean, he trails Kareem Abdul-Jabbar by only 4.8 points. And it's like, you know, we're not talking prime Kareem, but we're talking a pretty goddamn good Kareem at this time. And a really good team, like we said. There's a lot of decent players on this. And, you know, that Magic gets all the love for that historic Game 6. And rightfully so. The 1980 Game 6, Kareem is injured. Magic steps in, he takes the opening tip off, and then he has an incredible game, quote, at center. I mean, whatever, we don't have to get into all that right now. Yeah, but regardless, all you need to know, yes, he took the tip at center, yes, he played, it doesn't matter. He had 42 points and 15 rebounds, and they won the championship. It was good. Yeah. But show some love to Jamal Wilkes here. And this is actually a quote from Magic Johnson as well. He says, Jamal Wilkes had an unbelievable game. Everybody talked about my 42, but it was also his 34 or 37 point effort that helped us win that title. So yeah, he plays a huge role in that. So yeah, you don't have Kareem at his best. Yeah, Magic Johnson stepping up in his rookie year, but yeah, you have Jamal Wilkes, who's been on championship teams before with Golden State, stepping up here and being a huge part of this. And yeah, I think unfortunately, I don't know the reason why. I think maybe because more people identify with like the mid 80s Lakers. As opposed to, and he's on those teams too, but he's not as an important part of them. But like, yeah, he just doesn't, for whatever reason, when I hear the name Jamal Wilkes or when people talk about that era of Lakers, I don't know. You just don't hear his name all that much, but he's a very good player for a lot of those teams. And especially in this 1980 season, when he's still at his peak powers, he's so good on this team.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Yeah. 37 points, 10 rebounds in that game too.
Yeah. That's pretty good.
And, and he's definitely, you know, through 82, 83, he's still an excellent player. you know, kind of takes a step down as he gets into his early 30s. And they obviously have James Worthy and other guys to kind of step in and sort of fill his role a bit. But yeah, he absolutely, you know, he'd win two more titles with the Lakers, make a bunch of finals, actually was inducted in the Naismith Hall of Fame in 2012. So obviously a great career. But as, yeah, as you said, kind of, I think because the era that he was at his best, not as much video, not as much attention on the league, certainly doesn't quite get to the do there. But
yeah, when people think like 80s, you know, Lakers versus Celtics, it's the Worthy, Kareem, Magic, it's, you know, it's that team,
right.
Not yeah. necessarily this team. And he's on that, you know, he's on a few of those teams, or at least one of those teams, but
I think 85. But
it's just not, he's just never, for whatever reason, he's never considered a part of that dynasty. Maybe the way that he should be.
At least, not a key guy. Right. Absolutely. Yeah. So also 77, the New Orleans Jazz. A lot of Jazz and Lakers here so far. The Jazz made a good decision by signing Truck Robinson as a veteran free agent, sending Ron Behagen and cash to the Atlanta Hawks as compensation. So Robinson had only been in the league for 4 years. He spent 2.5 years with the Bullets. 77, he kind of broke out. He spent half the season with the Bullets and then half the season with the Hawks. With the Hawks, he'd averaged 22 points and 12.8 rebounds, so already stood out. But, you know, the Jazz, apparently they wanted Trek Moore. Certainly, you know, they were spending a lot of money trying to get a good team in New Orleans. And, 78 ended up, being their best team. And, Trek had kind of one of the great out-of-nowhere seasons ever. First-team All-NBA in 78. I think he was one of the first non-centers to lead the league in rebounding, 15.7 boards per game.
Yeah, he's like 6'7", by the way, too.
Right, kind of like Charles Barkley size, basically. Yeah, exactly. So, averages 22.7 points per game. Makes his first all-star appearance, as we mentioned, on the All-NBA first team. The Jazz barely missed the playoffs, 39-43. They're coached by Elgin Baylor. It was kind of their best chance to kind of stick it out in New Orleans. Maravich is kind of at his peak before injuries. I think Goodrich does, he has his best season, with the Jazz at 78. There, obviously he was fading, but he still was a bit of a contributor to that team. And he stays with it. It's a short term stint as the injuries pile up for Maravich. And I think that there was some tension between Truck and Maravich in 79. He first 43 games, he pretty much puts up very similar numbers. But the Jazz are slumping. They're on their way to only 26 win season, and they're going to soon to depart New Orleans. So, all that money they're paying for Truck Robinson and Gail Goodrich, probably not the best idea. So they ended up shopping him to the Suns for 2 first rounders.
Yeah, doesn't go very well for them. So they get Marty Burns, Ron Lee, 1979 first round pick Larry Knight. Not great. And the 1980 first round pick John Duren. So not great. And Truck, he would have a few more pretty productive years. I mean, he would make an all-star team in 1981 with the Suns, and obviously he'd have that run with like the 80s Knicks, the 83-85 with the Knicks, and then his career is going to be done. But an all-time great year here with the Jazz, and it's like this is one of the, like you said, one of the rare chances one of the rare times where the Jazz went out there, took a big risk, swung for the fences, and it worked out great. And then it's just, it didn't work out good enough to get them into the playoffs. And then it all kind of came crashing down for the franchise, which had, multitudes of issues at this point too. So you do wonder how things would have maybe gone a little bit different had they just hung on to him for a little bit longer or whatever. But no, he still has pretty good years with the Suns, and ended up having a pretty damn good NBA career for a second round pick. And he is a guy who always was regarded as one of the better all-time second-round picks. Now Draymond Green and a few other guys have probably passed him up at this point. But for a long time, Truck really, really stood out as an all-time great second-rounder.
Absolutely, And, probably the best free agent signing of this first year, Washington Bullets signing Bob Dandridge, the Milwaukee Bucks stalwart, kind of the last member of that, of the old championship team with Kareem, the, 71 title and 74 finals, as the Bucks are, moving on to a new era. All they get is cash, though. They don't get any picks out of that, which is, I guess, kind of a surprise. I mean, Dandridge was still, really good, productive player. Sort of interesting that, there were no picks involved for that. I mean, he averaged 20.8 points per game the season before. So, yes, but yeah, the Bucks, you know, again, they had a youth movement. They bounced back pretty good. So they were definitely an okay team. They never really quite, you know, bottomed out, but again, didn't really need Dandridge at this point. And the Bullets, you know, they'd been there for a while. You know, they obviously, you know, they have Elvin Hayes. They have Wes Unseld. You know, they make the 75 finals, but they're upset. 76, they are upset by the Cavs. But, you know, they're consistently, you know, a 50-plus win team, a team that seems like it could be, a championship-level team. But, you know, they struggled to get over the hump. 77, they had won 48 games, but then they end up being upset by the Rockets in the Eastern Conference semifinals. Yes, at that point, the Houston Rockets were in the East. So they decide, hey, we're going to get Bob Dedrich. He's, you know, been a big game player in the past. He's a great defender. He just kind of gives a really good scorer, just kind of gives them something that they needed, you know. And they end up kind of struggling in the regular season because of injuries, but they end up making and winning the NBA Finals, defeating the Sonics in seven games. And then Dandridge, he fits in great. You know, he's 19.3 points per game, second best of the team. Average 21.2 in the playoffs and 20.4 in the NBA Finals. Does not win the Finals MVP, although a lot of people think that he definitely could have done so. Stays with Washington for a couple more years, including the 1975 Finals loss, and then ends up finishing his career with a brief stint in Milwaukee to wrap things up. And he's also recently inducted into Hall of Fame in 2021. Yeah. Definitely one of the great omissions from that. So great to see him in the Hall of Fame.
They must have listened to our complaining about it over the years. There's still a few more left to go, but hey, you know, they've listened and we're getting there. So
we'll take it. Yeah, absolutely. So I know, Rich, that you are the world's biggest Jim Clemens fan. So I think you want to talk about the next one.
Let's talk about the guy who's definitely the most important part of this next signing, which is Jim Clemens. This is in 1977, obviously, in October of 1997. The New York Knicks signed Jim Clemens as a veteran free agent, and they decide, all right, we need to send the Cleveland Cavaliers something. These guys want something. All right. I don't know. Walt Frazier. Here you go. What?
Right. Yeah.
And we did this earlier in the year. We watched one of these old Cleveland Cavaliers games where Walt Frazier, it was our holiday episode, I believe, this year.
Yeah.
And the sight of Walt Frazier in a Cavs uniform is horrific. And I'm not even from New York. Like, I don't care about the Knicks. I couldn't possibly care less about the Knicks. But it is horrific to see Walt Frazier in a Cavs uniform. I hate it so much. I don't know why they did this. It's so weird. So there, we found some quotes actually from the New York Times. Walt Frazier says, I was traded to Cleveland. It was like getting traded to Siberia. There was one reporter on the weekend. There was no reporter. So very different from, what Walt Frazier was used to, in New York. And this is from the New York Times article reacting to it. It says the Knicks are expected to announce today that they are sending the 32-year-old Frazier, a guard who was once the high priest of Madison Square Garden basketball, to the Cleveland Cavaliers as compensation for the impending signing of Jim Clemens, a 28-year-old playmaker. The 6'3" Clemens, a free agent, played for the Cavaliers the last five seasons. As further part of the transaction, the Knicks will pay part of Frazier's salary of more than $400,000 a year. His contract has three seasons to run. So, obviously, the Knicks have fallen on some hardish times. They'd missed the last two playoffs, and Frazier was falling out of favor, in the Knicks land as well. He had no longer been the team captain. Roman Rowe took his place. Willis Reed had replaced Red Holzman as the Knicks coach, and this, again, from the New York Times, quote, he is trying to restore some semblance of team play on a squad of superstars who played too much one-on-one. Instead of Frazier's dribbling the ball up court slowly, Reed wants the Knicks to run consistently. He wants a playmaker who will direct the team and play and run more. Frazier did not fit into these plans. So, things are not going great for Walt Frazier, the Knicks, and Willis Reed and all that sort of stuff. So he is sent to Cleveland. They're bringing in 6'3 playmaker, 28-year-old Jim Clemens. He averages 6.5 points per game in his first year in New York.
They did now. They went from sixth in the league in pace to third in the league in pace.
So, stepped it up.
Yeah, yes. They did.
So they did return to the playoffs. So
That's true.
You know, throw some roses to Jim Clemens. Sure. Yes.
Yeah.
Bob McAdoo was really good. Sure. Yes. And, Earl Monroe.
They beat the Cavs in the playoffs, too.
Exactly. Yeah, so a little bit of a revenge series. So there you go. And then Jim Clemens says, screw the haters. He has 9.5 points per game his second year.
Oh, wow.
And you can imagine if he got better, you know, the Knicks got better. Actually, they won 31 games. Willis Reed was fired. Red Holzman was brought back in. And then Jim Clemens, 22 games in the 1980 season, was sent back to the Washington, or was sent to the Washington Bullets. And then, I can't wait. This is not, if you think this is the only time we're going to talk about Frank Burkowski on this show, maybe not. Yeah. Maybe not. Yeah. But December 4th, 1979, the Knicks trade Jim Clemens to the Washington Bullets for a 1981 third-round pick. And that third-round pick ends up becoming Frank Burkowski, who, again, you never know. We might talk about Frank Burkowski later.
You never know. Yeah, absolutely. A huge time for everybody. You know, it was a wonderful. It was the era of Brick House and a Brick House.
Right,
you know?
Right.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, every car was driving by playing Brick House. Everybody was thinking of Frank Burkowski.
Frank Burkowski, absolutely. Yeah. I believe
I wasn't alive, so I'll just have to take your word for it. But
I was alive and very, I was a very knowledgeable 2-year-old about the world at that point. So, absolutely. So, yes, more 1977. It's a hot offseason. So, in October, the Seattle Supersonics sign Gus Williams as a veteran free agent, sent cash to the Warriors competition. So, Williams, he'd spent 2 years with the Warriors, actually joined the defending champion as a rookie in 76, played his way in a key role. You know, was fifth in the team in minutes, fourth in scoring. So, you know, he wasn't obviously not one of the absolute most key players, but he was definitely an important part of that role. You know, they win 59 games, which is the league best. But they fell apart in the 76 players, lost to the underdog Suns in the conference finals. And then, you know, his last season in Golden State, they have Rick Barry still, getting older, but, you know, still great. They have Jamal Wilkes, you know, as a future Laker. And they've got rookie Robert Parrish, as well as, you know, Phil Smith, who'd been All-NBA, and Gus Williams be a future All-NBA, only finished with 46 wins. You know, the chemistry, not great there. You know, the ownership situation, not great. And, hey, you know, the Warriors don't want to pay Gus Williams enough, despite, you know, being talented. And the federal judge, Robert L. Carter, who actually had jurisdiction in all contract disputes as a part of the Oscar Robertson settlement, which is funny. One judge, you know, had that, you know, in that case. It's really.
Is he like, oh, the NBA case? How about that? He was like a hoops man.
Yeah,
I guess.
Yeah. You know,
they're splitting them up. They're like, all right, we got this murder, we got this. He's like, oh, how about the NBA contract dispute?
Yeah. That's me. Yeah. So good. And he signs with the Sonics for $170,000 per year. Oh, the Sonics, yeah.
Rich man. What is he going to do with $170,000?
I don't know. Yeah. So, and then, yeah, he part of the, of course, the backcourt with Dennis Johnson. They've got Jack Sikma, helps lead the Sonics to a surprise finals appearance in 1978 and then an NBA title in 1979. You know, things are looking good. And we're going to jump ahead here, but it's related to the situation. So I think it's worth getting into now. After the Sonics fell to the Lakers in the 1980 playoffs, Williams has another more infamous contract dispute that leads him to sit out the entire 1981 season. So the Sonics, you know, 2 years ago are the championship. Now, you know, they've gotten rid of Dennis Johnson. They traded him for Paul Westphal, but unfortunately Paul Westphal gets hurt, misses a lot of the season with injury. Lonnie Shelton, another one of the key players from the 79 title team, I think only plays 14 games that year. So, you know, they're snake bitten. They only win 34 games that year. And then what I had not read until, you know, there was an article from Sports Illustrated in February of 81 talking about this. He actually nearly signed a one-year deal under his old terms in December of 80. Even flew to Portland with the expectation that he would sign the deal and then he would play that night. But then, you know, looking over the contract, there was a dispute over whether the Sonics would be entitled to compensation once Williams became a free agent, prevented it from signing. You know, this is right at the time that compensation is no longer going to be automatic, but because of the idea of whether he'd be tied to the old contract or a new one, you know, they ends up not doing it. Anyway, all all's well that ends well. He finally returns to the Sonics in the 81 offseason, signs a 5-year deal worth $600,000, leads him to a 52-win season and a first-team All-NBA appearance and a Comeback Player of the Year award win, which is one of the rare ones that was not drug-related. So, so good times there.
Absolutely, yeah.
Yeah.
So we said, you know, not super eventful, but there's some pretty eventful stuff in the 1977 thing. So,
That's a good
people
one.
Trying to figure out the landscape here, trying to figure out what's going on. And, that's going to continue for the next few seasons here.
Absolutely will. Yes. 1978, not quite as big, but, you know, some interesting names here. We've got Alex English, signs with the Indiana Pacers. Yes, he played and signed with the Indiana Pacers as a veteran free agent. And the Pacers sent the Milwaukee Bucks, who English played for before, a first round pick that later ended up being Calvin Natt, to the Milwaukee Bucks. So English, pretty little used in his first two seasons, Milwaukee, averaging 9.6 points per game in about 19 minutes per game. So per minute, scored a lot, but didn't play a whole lot. He did, however, have a pretty strong run in the 78 playoffs, led the league in field goal percentage in the playoffs at 615. The Bucks ended up taking the favored Nuggets in the second round to 7 games. So, you know, the Bucks kind of recovering from, the Kareem Abdul-Jabbar trade and, you know, hoarding draft picks and getting some young players. And, hey, they bounced back. They got Don Nelson as their coach. Things are looking up for them. However, you know, English not happy with his role there. There's a lot of depth with young depth there. And the Pacers are like, you know what? We're going to take him and we're going to see what we can do. And he plays reasonably well there. He averages 15.6 points per game, 135 games over 2 seasons. So not the quite the stalwart scorer that he would be, but definitely, you know, showed some talent. But the Pacers, they had a habit, especially the late 70s, of constantly trading away and bringing back players and having a lot of short stints for guys. Billy Knight, you know, they train, they bring back. They have Adrian Dantley for a short time.
Yeah,
they have John Williamson for a short time. Just a bunch of weary of James Edwards. They have a lot of guys who end up like having pretty good careers, but they only stay in Milwaukee for a long time. And they see a chance to bring back George McGinnis. So George McGinnis, he'd been an MVP in Indiana for the ABA. He'd been one of the great players, in their history. Still only 29. He'd been an all-star the previous season. Some slippage was obvious, but the amount of slippage probably not so obvious. So they bring him back home from Denver. They give up English and a first rounder to do so. Unfortunately, McGinnis, not much left in the tank, and English ends up, you know, famously with the most points of any player during the 1980s for the Denver Nuggets. So kind of a blip in history, but just sort of an interesting name there and kind of interesting story.
Absolutely. Yeah, let's go to the next one here. This is in 1978 as well. The Atlanta Hawks signed Don Runfield in as a veteran free agent and send 1979 first round pick Dudley Bradley, which is a great name,
Dudley Bradley,
to the Indiana Pacers as compensation. Yeah. And Runfield had evolved into a pretty solid double-double threat over 3 seasons with the Pacers. But as you mentioned, the franchise, many times strapped for cash, could not afford the price the Hawks were willing to pay and said, there you go, you can have him. And he's a name that a lot of people don't know or don't remember all that much, but had a pretty underrated career with the Hawks. 6 seasons, he was 5 times all defensive, 3-time all-star as well, 17.6 points per game, 10.7 rebounds per game, and 1.6 blocks per game. And you have a fun little story here from somebody we've talked to on the show before about something, you know, what could have happened, some dominoes falling in the case of Runfield.
Right. Yeah, Mark Bonte, you know, he reported in an article at NBA.com, basically, if the Pacers had somehow been able to keep Runfield, you know, at a price that they would have been able to afford, as we said, they really were strapped for cash in the late 70s. You know, famously had that telethon to try to save the team and, you know, ended up, you know, nearly selling out to a team from Sacramento before the Simons stepped in and kept the team there. But yeah, they likely would have picked Larry Bird in the 1978 draft. So, but because they lost Runfield, they felt like they needed to bring somebody who could play right away. And then, you know, ended up not really working out. They didn't sign Larry Bird, and they ended up drafting Rick Roby. And
so I would say it's safe to say it did not work
out. Yeah. And getting Johnny Davis, you know, yeah. So you probably would rather have Larry Bird in that. You probably want to wait a year.
I think so.
Larry Bird,
yeah.
Yeah. So yeah, the quote is, yeah, Slick Leonard, he wanted to get Bird and then wait a year, figuring that they would get a whole lot of ticket orders, you know, from, you know, throughout the state. You know, Bird was already, you know, an Indiana legend. And you know, the team's ownership and executive board, they wanted to try to get a name player. Leonard said, if we'd been able to keep Brown Field, then we would have had the luxury of waiting on Bird, because we would have a player who, you know, would have kept the team afloat and, you know, was a good enough deer. And, you know, obviously people did not know what Larry Bird was going to become. I mean, they knew he was talented, but obviously, you know, they had no foresight to realize. You know, there was questions about whether he was going to be athletic enough in the NBA, whether he would translate well, you know, all those things. But that were reasonable questions, yeah. You know, so, yeah. But it's interesting. It's certainly interesting, yeah.
Definitely, definitely. All right, let's talk about one of our favorite guys. Do it, Jason.
Absolutely. Rick Barry. Yes, yeah. The Houston Rockets. You know, they decide to, obviously, as we said, Rockets for your prick. The Rockets decide to sign, you know, the notorious NBA prick, Rick Barry. yes.
Noted NBA penis, Rick Barry.
Right, yes. So our friends at Manscaped would appreciate that.
Of course, yes. Yes. Fan side of 20, 20% off plus free shipping.
Absolutely. Yes. So, things, as we mentioned, you know, kind of not going well in Golden State. The Rick Barry decides to move on, go into the Rockets. The Rockets end up sending John Lucas, who was the number one pick overall just a couple seasons before, going to the Warriors. And yeah, Barry, 34 at the time, still effective. He had spent 8 years in two separate stints with the Warriors, leading them to the 1975 NBA title, of course. There's a New York Times article from that time talking about a press conference attended by Barry and his attorneys who had flown into Houston earlier that day. Barry said, "I look forward to working with the Rockets, and I've always been impressed with the awesome offensive potential of the team. I will do whatever Coach Tom Nasaki wants me to do, even come off the bench." Nasaki said, was asked if he had planned to use Barry as substitute. He laughed and said, "No way." And basically, Barry said, "Hey, this was, you know, Golden State's been good to me, but it's a business decision. You know, Houston showed the most interest in him. He wanted to be a team that would be competitive, could win a championship, and wanted to go to an area where he would enjoy living," which fairly practical. And, you know, it seemed like on paper, like a pretty good team. Like they got Moses Malone, who, had just been the MVP in 78. He had not been the MVP in 78, but he had clearly established himself as one of the great big men in the league and would win the MVP in 79. They've got Rui Tomjanovic. Of course, he's returning from the injury after, you know, the fight with Grant Washington. They still got Calvin Murphy, who's good. They got Billy Paltz, who's a solid center. They got a couple of decent young players in Robert Reed and Alan Neville. Never quite took off in Barry's 2 years there. And then, of course, they do make the finals the year after Barry leaves, despite, you know, being a 40-42 team in 1981. Lucas, in the meantime, you know, he'd been number one overall pick, as we mentioned, but it only averaged 12.7 points per game and 8.1 assists per game in two seasons there. But he did help the Rockets to what ended up being a surprise Eastern Conference Finals appearance in 1977. But Houston really fell off the next season. You know, obviously they lost Rui Tomjanovic because of the injury, because of the fight. And Moses Malone had only played about half the season. So definitely part of that. Lucas, you know, had many ups and downs in his career, eventually overcoming a drug addiction, running a substance abuse recovery program, spent a lot of time coaching. There's an article that Lucas talked about the trade. He said, "We all knew the Rockets were going to have to give up something good, real good. The fact is they wanted either me or Moses Malone, and I didn't like the idea that some people thought Moses was better, though he clearly was." And Lucas said, "Well, he didn't really blame, you know, the commissioner Larry O'Brien for the move to the West Coast for his problem. He said I was already headed for disaster, but just speeded the process up." Of course, you know, Golden State known for really being a bad place for, you know, players that had drug addiction. You know, there were notorious hotels in the area and just, you know, just not a great culture there, obviously. So
yeah, Bay Area, not a great place to to stay off of drugs. So, yeah.
Exactly. Yes. Yes. Unfortunately. So, yeah. That's that. What do we got next?
We get a little less exciting here in 1978 as well. The New York Knicks trade Lonnie Shelton and a 1979 first-round pick, eventually Vinny Johnson, two of the Seattle Supersonics for a 1981 first-round pick, Steve Johnson, a lot of Johnsons, Yes, Manscaped again. We had dicks like Rick Barry, and we have Manscaped dicks.
We had Johnson's.
Exchange. This is the most. This exchange was arranged as compensation for New York signing veteran free agent Marvin Webster on September 29th, 1978. Seattle later gave the 1981 pick back to the Knicks. That's incredible.
I mean, they were forced to, but yes.
So. Right. I like the idea that they're like, ah, here you go. We don't.
We don't need it.
We thought we needed it. We don't actually need it. You guys can have it. It's fine. We have enough. We're good. We have enough picks. Take it back, please.
It's really nice. Everyone else with them.
Rewrapped it. It's like, here, take it. Just have it. So, known as the Human Eraser, an incredible name. Webster was the number 3 overall pick in the 1975 NBA draft. But if you remember his name, and along with him and number 1 overall pick David Thompson, they said screw this, and they went to the ABA. They went to the Denver Nuggets in the ABA. He was diagnosed with a form of hepatitis. He unfortunately played only 38 games as a rookie, averaged just 4.3 points per game and 4.6 rebounds per game. Finally, after a healthier season in Denver, him and Paul Silas were sent to the Sonics, where Webster did finally break out 14 points per game, 12.6 rebounds per game, and 2 blocks per game for the team that made it to the NBA Finals. And then, obviously, his team, they lost narrowly in that Game 7, but he played a great game, 27 points, 19 rebounds, 4 blocks. And as we mentioned in a prior episode, almost single-handedly making up for Dennis Johnson's 0 for 14 performance. That did not help anybody. Another Johnson here, if you're keeping track. Webster had another double-double season in 1979, but he had additional health issues. And in 1980, he had a consecutive game streak of 333 games with the Knicks before finally retiring after that. But so guys kind of move around a little bit here, but Lonnie Shelton ended up being a better fit for the Sonics than Webster really was. So he adapted very quickly to the Sonics. He teamed with Jack Sikma and John Johnson. A lot of Johnsons here. With Gus Williams and Dennis Johnson in the backcourt, Seattle finishes 52-3. This is why we talked about it in the other episode. That one announcer just called everybody VJ and SJ and DJ because he was like, there's too many Johnsons. What are you going to do?
There were 3 Johnsons.
There were so many. Yeah. Jeez, right. Seattle. Get your head out of the gutter here. Seattle finishes 52-30 in the regular season, then outlast the Suns in a rugged 7-game series in the Western Conference Finals. And then they get an NBA title win over the Washington Bullets in 5 games. And so, a lot of things, the Sonics, they led the season in fewest points allowed and lowest field goal percentages allowed. And a lot of that is due to Shelton. He was a great defender. Jack Sikma said the main thing is Lonnie was a big physical presence, and we always had one of the best defenses in the league, and we were one of the best rebounding teams in the league, and he was a perfect fit. Just put it this way, nobody wanted to mess with Lonnie. I had my best rebounding years when I was side by side with Lonnie, and the big key was his man was always boxed out. Lonnie had a body on him, and there was a lot of room to go get balls. this is a very, and a lot of this credit to Lonnie and his ability to dominate his man. So
that's pretty good. Domination. Yeah. A lot of, yes. Yeah. No, I think that's, it's really interesting how that worked out. And, unfortunately, Marvin Webster and Lonnie Shelton both, passed away tragically early, as they were at a very young age for both of them, in their late 50s, early 60s. So, another sad thing that they, have in common, but, it was an interesting one. I mean, it seemed really important at the time, and then ended up, because of Webster, not really, having the longevity, and ended up, the health issues kind of derailed his career. Didn't end up, becoming a star that he kind of potentially seemed like he would be. But after, that season with Seattle, and after, helping lead them to the finals, that was definitely, I think, the expectation at the time. So, that is interesting how that worked out. So I think we're gonna move into 1979, my birth year. Yeah. So exciting times. The first one, you might have heard about this. The San Diego Clippers sign Bill Walton as a veteran free agent. And Kevin Kunert, Kermit Washington, and a 1980 first-round pick that ends up being Mike Kaminsky go to the Portland Trailblazers. So, there's a whole book about this. So, we don't need to get into, I think, every nook and cranny about this, but obviously, Walton, one of the best, certainly in some respects, controversial athlete of his day for, his political beliefs and his dress and all that. But he had led the Trailblazers to the 1977 title, won the 1978 MVP, a foot injury in that playoffs, preventing the Blazers from having a chance to repeat. missed the 1979 season entirely with that same injury and accused the Blazers medical staff of mishandling that injury, basically ending his interest in being there. So he has the chance to jump ship to his new hometown team. They had just moved from Buffalo, you know, and then they famously there had been the exchange of a franchises between the Celtics and the Braves, you know, where a lot of the old Celtics end up going to the Braves and then moving across to San Diego. Now, this is actually the second year they would have been in San Diego. They'd actually been a solid team already. So feeling like, oh yeah, they're already been a solid team, won about 40 games, and they're going to get a chance to get Bill Walton. Well, unfortunately, it does not go well in the court. Walton only appears in just 14 games his first season and then misses entirely the following two seasons because of multiple surgeries on his foot. He does return in the 83 season, plays 88 games over the next two seasons, which were the Clippers last in San Diego. And then they end up moving to Los Angeles in 1984. Walton plays 1 year there before being traded to the Boston Celtics. And ends up, you know, things of course go well in Boston. He, in 85, 86, he, you know, plays basically the entire season, named sixth man of the year, and they win the championship, one of the great teams of all time. And there is an article from ESPN.com about, Bill Walton talking about, you know, blaming himself for the Clippers' 1984 departure from San Diego. He called it, his quote is, "It's my greatest failure as a professional in my entire life. I could not get the job done in my hometown. It is a stain and stigma on my soul that is indelible. I'll never be able to wash that off, and I carry it with me forever."
I mean,
yeah.
Does he? Maybe he does. I mean, it's his quote, so I can't say what's going on in his mind, but I don't know. I feel like he had a pretty good life otherwise. But, maybe. All right, maybe.
Yeah. Hey, you know, it's who are we to argue?
It would have been cool to have him be awesome for a team in San Diego. That would have been awesome. But unfortunately, yeah, well. Donald Sterling, whatever. Anyway. Maybe it's better.
Okay, dude.
We had 20 more years of his, or 30 more years of his terrible. Anyway, yeah, that would have been fun, but did not end up happening. Let's move on next here. 1979 again. The Washington Bullets signed Kevin Porter as a veteran free agent and sent a 1980 first round pick Ricky Brown on a 1982 first round pick, which eventually G'd John Bagley to the Detroit Pistons as compensation. Yeah, the Kevin Porter stuff. I mean, we've on this show, we have tried to let people know that Kevin Porter was like a thing. Yeah, he was a really, really good player for a lot of different teams. The problem was he never had one home base. He bounced around a bunch of times. It never really felt like, I don't know, he was overshadowed by a lot of other players in the league. He wasn't a prolific scorer, but he was one of the great passers of his day. I mean, he led the NBA four different times in assists per game, and they were in different times. They were 1975, 1978 with two different teams, 1979, and then again in 1981. I mean, it's like it wasn't like one run that he had with one team where it was like, this is the perfect situation for Kevin Porter. Like, this is on multiple teams that he did this on. This is on the Bullets. This is on the Pistons and the Nets. This is on Detroit. This is on the Bullets again because he would go there twice. But anyway, yeah, it's 1979, and yeah, he had, you know, led the league in assists per game four different times. He also held a single game record for assists, 29 for 12 seasons until Scott Skiles finally beat him out for it. He also had 9 games of 20 or more assists, more than anyone except for John Stockton, who had 13. And he had a bit of a kind of an odd path. So he started his career with 3 years with the Bullets. Then he was traded to the Pistons for Dave Bing. Had a very brief stint with the Nets. Then he was traded back to the Pistons, and then back to the Bullets, where he finished his career. So a lot of Bullets, a lot of Pistons, and some Nets thrown in there, as well. But Porter here is going to go to the defending NBA finalists, helping to try to mitigate the loss of Tom Henderson to Houston. And
NBA Finals hero Tom Henderson. You know, Tom Henderson of the buzzer beater. Right?
Oh yeah. Of course.
Yeah. Right.
But. So we have a Washington Post article from 1979 talking about it. It says, quote, "The addition of the high-stepping, crowd-pleasing Porter, who was known as the Little Drum Major when he played in Washington from 1979. Not a good nickname. I don't know about that.
No, you don't like it? No.
The Little Drum Major? I don't know.
It's colorful.
So here's the...
I mean, they just call him, like, K-Port now. If, you know, if
it yeah, exactly. Modern, well, right? Yeah. And here's... So he's got two names listed on Basketball Reference. He has Little Drummer Boy.
Okay.
And the conductor, but the Washington Post says Little Drum Major. So I wonder.
I like the conductor. That's pretty good.
The conductor's great. Yeah, that makes a Little Drum Major. I don't know. That doesn't quite. The conductor though. That's
the conductor. I'm in
now for that. That sounds good. Right. But anyway, so he already played in Washington. Is expected to make the Bullets a more exciting and stronger team. I think we're a better team right now than we were at most any time last year. Bullet coach Dick Mata said yesterday. From his off-season home in Fishhaven, Idaho, of course. Mata would live in Fishhaven, Idaho. Isn't Dick Mata the one that we found out runs an Airbnb still?
Hotel. Right, yeah.
Is that in Fishhaven, Idaho? It was somewhere in Idaho. I don't know Western Idaho geography very well.
You don't know your Idaho geography. I'm just putting
I'm not even sure if Fishhaven is on the – what? No, it is on the – I don't know anything about Idaho. I'm currently scrolling on Google Maps. Okay, so Fishhaven is on the far east side of Idaho. But I think the place that we saw that he runs an Airbnb in is, I thought it was the west side of Idaho.
I could be completely wrong,
but we need to book that before Dick dies. Because, I mean, he's getting up there in age, so we better...
complete your part, and I'll try to see
if please, I can... Okay, please figure out which... town Dick Mata runs an Airbnb in so that we can
It appears to be the Bluebird Inn Bed and Breakfast at Bear Lake, and it says that it looks like Bear Lake State Park. It's on the Idaho Utah border.
So he stayed there forever then. He was like, this place rules. I'm gonna stay here as a coach and I'm gonna run a beautiful Airbnb. We got to go to that. We have to go to that.
I believe we're gonna go. Yeah, we'll record a live episode there.
We kind of have to. Yeah,
yeah.
Do a Manscaped read in front of Dick Mata. I'm sure he'd do that.
Yeah, we could.
Speaking of dicks, let's talk about Manscaped. He's like, come on, I my years on this earth are like really low. Like, I don't want to spend 20 minutes listening to you idiots talk about NBA history, but we're gonna do it anyway. I think a quote here from him as well. I think Elvin Hayes and Bobby Dandridge will have good as or better years than they did last year, and the fast break baskets and cherry picking we get from Kevin will make us a more exciting team. Does he mean cherry picking in the sense that I think he means, or does he mean like stealing the ball?
Yeah, I think stealing the ball, and then basically the idea that they'd already be under the basket. You know, they'd already have run the floor or have not had to go down as far to the floor.
Yeah.
similar concept, but I don't think directly cherry picking.
Right. We have two more quotes here, then we'll give you the unfortunate end to all these quotes. All right. So I don't want to gush so much that it makes Tom Henderson look bad because he did a good job for us. We won a world championship with him, but to lose your playmaker and come up with a prize like Porter to take his place has to excite you. I'm having a tough time right now. Not getting too excited. Fishhaven, Idaho. He's getting too excited. Can't even catch fish. He's too excited.
That's a good Manscaped read right there. Yeah.
Right. I remember as soon as the season was over, I told Bob Ferry that I didn't want to go to camp with the same team we had. I thought we needed something new. And boy, we got something new. The boredom will be gone from camp now. So Kevin Porter, this is just going to totally transform the Washington Bullets.
Yeah,
I mean,
absolutely.
This is just going to, I mean, all those quotes there from Dick Mata. The Bullets, they had 54 wins the year prior. They fell to 39 wins. The roster was old and everybody got hurt.
Yeah.
So.
Right. Yeah. Oh, well.
Yeah, you know, I can't win them all, but hey, and then
then
he pretty much was done. Yeah, he's pretty much he started to slow down a little bit, and
it went to the Mavericks. You know, goes right from the Bulls to the Mavericks, right?
Yep.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, there you go. All right,
Kevin Porter did. To be fair to Porter, he did in 1981. He did lead the league in assists, but
He played well. You know, 13.4. And then basically, then injuries kind of derail the rest of his career. He only plays 11 games in his career after that. So, unfortunately, sort of toward the end for him. But, notable at the time, certainly. I always could talk about Kevin Porter, the conductor.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Little drummer boy little drum major, whichever one you want to put.
I think we'll respect him and call him the conductor from now on.
Sounds great.
All right, cool. Yes. And the Boston Celtics trade Bob McAdoo to the Detroit Pistons for two 1980 first-round draft picks. One of them is Ricky Brown. The other is Joe Barry Carroll. That, of course, that's a name that I think most of our listeners know from another trade that this led to. But so this exchange arranged as compensation for Boston signing ML Carr, which had been about about 6 weeks earlier. So they negotiate this. The Celtics had acquired Bob McAdoo, I think, for 3 draft picks. That was a trade that the team owner, John White Brown, had made without consulting Red Auerbach. Probably not a great idea, you know, overall. So, you know, Bob McAdoo didn't like the Celtics. The Celtics didn't like Bob McAdoo. And Bob McAdoo even said, he found out from on the front page of the New York Times sports section that, yeah, he'd been traded to what he called his least favorite city, Boston. So the Knicks never really never called him to reveal the trade. He said Michael Ray Richardson had stopped by his house to let him know. So he would later on a podcast with Cedric Maxwell, Michael Cooper, he said, I didn't want to go to Boston because I was hated in Boston. And I hated Boston myself, considered it the most racist city in the NBA. So, you know, wasn't happy about that. Things didn't go great there. There's a New York Times article from September of 79, right after the trade. Said that McAdoo virtually forced the trade. His ego had been hurt when Dave Cowens, the player coach, did not start him regularly. The bitterness carried over into the offseason, even though Bill Fitch had become the coach and Cowens was set to return playing center. He said, I didn't want to be in Boston because of Dave Cowens. He sat me down because he didn't like the idea of me being there last season. The team didn't have enough talent to keep me sitting. And Cowens, also not a fan of McAdoo, didn't really want to play with him. So they were happy to leave each other. And then McAdoo would say he was happy to go to a team that wanted him in Detroit. He had 3 years remaining on a $450,000 a year contract. He signed with the Knicks. He said, it'll be a pleasure to play alongside a bona fide center like Bob Lanier for the first time in my 7-season career. Dick Vitale, who was the Pistons coach at this time, says it's a good deal for Boston and a great deal for us. Well, not great. So the Celtics that year, they win, you know, 50 plus games. They end up going to they don't go to the finals, but they end up going to the conference finals and losing to the Sixers. The Pistons, well, yes, they finish 16-66. Dick Vitale is gone after a 4-8 start. The Pistons finally trade the long-suffering Bob Lanier to the Bucks. Statistically, McAdoo, you know, still plays okay, 21.1 points per game and 8.1 rebounds per game. Clearly slipped, though, despite only being 28. He'd averaged almost 27 points per game his first 8 seasons. So definitely his numbers were down. His interest in playing was down. And because of that trade, the Pistons, despite having the worst record in the league, don't even have a pick. The Celtics get the number 1 overall pick in that coin flip, and they end up trading Jobari Carroll for Kevin McHale and Robert Parrish, basically setting themselves up for the rest of the decade, along with Bird, of course. McAdoo only plays 6 games for the 81 Pistons, gets into a dispute with the team, who he says won't play him despite him being healthy. You know, perhaps it was the Pistons trying to tank or trying to – there's some talk of maybe trying to depress McAdoo's, you know, next contract or what have you. But there's an article in the New York Times in March of 81 kind of outlining all of this. McAdoo ends up being released 6 days after the article comes out and signs with the Nets. He plays 10 games with the Nets at the end of the 81 season, averaging 9.3 points per game, 2.6 rebounds per game, and 1 assist per game in just 15 minutes per game. So, you know, the Nets don't have a lot of interest in playing a whole lot. Doesn't end up signing with the Nets during that offseason, but they still kind of hold his rights. So, they didn't come to terms with him because he had high salary demands. And then he ends up getting traded to the Lakers and being, you know, a key part of their bench run, of course, you know, for the next season. He's got to reinvent himself as a player. I know we've talked about it before, but yeah, he definitely really, went from, you know, being like one of the elite players in the league into being, you know, basically a pariah, in just a couple years, and not really, you know, it wasn't like, you know, there's a lot of situations like this where there were like drugs involved and there was some obvious slippage of play, but here it was just like, you know, it wasn't like a complete jerk or anything. It just was just like a situation where he got put in situations where he was just, not happy to be there. And it was just like a kind of a weird 70s thing, I guess.
Definitely. Yeah. We've done multiple shows where we've talked about how weird his career was and how he might not get enough respect because that the last half of his career is just so weird and so strange, and he doesn't have one home base and there's not one spot. But yeah, just a tremendous player that unfortunately got caught up in a few pretty bad situations. But all right, so we ready to move on to 1980 here? It's not going to get exciting, people. 1980 right. is everybody got quick. Sick. Everybody got sick of free agency in 1980 and said, let's just not do anything. So, all right, we'll start here There's a few here. So the San Diego Clippers, they hire Paul Silas as head coach. The Seattle SuperSonics trade Paul Silas to the San Diego Clippers. It's one of these weird kind of head coach trade things. Hey, if you're going to sign our coach, you got to give us something. The Seattle SuperSonics say, how about a 1985 second round pick? And they go, sure, okay.
Sounds great.
And they draft somebody named Calvin Duncan, who we're not going to talk about Calvin Duncan because it's Calvin Duncan. Silas, he inherited a Clippers team and a franchise that still at this point was somewhat kind of mildly somewhat sort of respectable. Little bit. I mean, they had come from the Buffalo Braves, and the Braves obviously had some pretty good season and some pretty good players and stuff. And the San Diego Clippers were, it was like, hey, they're doing stuff. They're trying to be competitive. Right. They're trying to make this a thing.
Yeah.
They had won 43 games the year prior, the first year in San Diego, and they fell to 35-47, but it's the Clippers, and that's not bad. You know what I mean? That's okay. So Silas, obviously a former NBA player, gets his first coaching gig here. It starts well. It does not end well. As we said, Silas goes 36-46 his first year. Then the bottom falls out. They go 17-65 the next year, the worst in franchise history. At least at that point, the worst in franchise history. Do not worry. The Clippers, they're going to make up for that in the future in 1982. And then they followed up in 25-57 record in 1983. And that is it for Paul, who would then unfortunately have to become an assistant for like another decade plus. Before finally getting another head coaching gig with the Charlotte Hornets in 1999. And he'd make four straight playoffs with the Charlotte / New Orleans Hornets as well as they moved to New Orleans during that period too. I guess you can add Oklahoma City to that. That's important as well.
Yes. Yes. So a couple more 1980. Very, very much footnotes. But the Kansas City Kings signed Leon Douglas as a veteran free agent and sent a 1981 first round pick that ended up being Kelly Tripucka to the Pistons as compensation. So the Pistons, they get a pick back after the situation with McAdoo. They would get draft picks and they would use them pretty well starting in 81. You know, they get Kelly Tripucka, they would get Isaiah Thomas. So things would get better there pretty quickly. But yes, so and the Kings end up they were okay. They were kind of mediocre. So that's a 12th pick where they get Tripucka. And Tripucka, you know, he's an all-star his rookie year and averages, 20 for points per game for the early 80s Pistons. So solid player there. Also, the Atlanta Hawks signed Tom Burleson as a veteran free agent. Mm-hmm. And then a 1981 second-round pick, Eddie Johnson, goes to the Kings. So, you know, the Kings lose a first-round pick in Kelly Tripucka, but they get a good second-rounder, Eddie Johnson.
Yeah, they get a very productive second-rounder, yeah.
Yeah, so, yeah, Burleson, he was a pretty good, NBA big man. He's like 7'2". He was a pretty good NBA big man and, for Seattle for a few years. Injuries kind of failed him at this point, and he doesn't have much more of a career. But honestly, he's really best known. He was involved in the 1972 Olympics, of course, there's the hostage situation, and he ends up at one point having a gun drawn upon him, and he's the person with the last known sight of the Israeli hostages before they were murdered. So that's nuts. I did not realize that he was, actually like in the middle of that situation.
Yeah, I didn't either. I mean, he's lucky to be alive. I mean, honestly, and that's, I think the quotes I was able to find is he like at the time was just kind of like, well, that's kind of strange. What the hell's going on here? Like whatever. And then, he'll find out pretty soon that like, everybody got murdered. I mean, it was just a horrible, horrible situation. So that could have been much, even that much more worse as he was just kind of in the wrong place at the wrong time. And then to add into his really, really awesome time in Munich for the 1972 Olympics, he's on that Team USA that loses to the Soviet Union in the gold medal game, which obviously was under much suspicion.
Scrutiny about that, yeah.
Yeah, so I'm imagining when Tom got back to U.S. soil, he was like, yep, that was kind of stupid. Like, that was not a very fun trip to Munich, Germany. I don't think I want to go back. Yeah, I had a gun drawn on me. Yeah. I was next to a horrible, horrible massacre. And then, you know, we had the Soviet Union game. So, yeah, this is great.
I had to spend time with Doug Collins.
I had to be in the same place as Doug Collins a lot. Eventful summer there. So,
yeah. And yeah, the Kings end up getting Eddie Johnson. Yeah, he spent 6 years with the Kings franchise. One other key score before, you know, goes to Phoenix and Seattle and bounces around the league for, you know, last half of his career, ends up being on the lasting to the point where he's on the Charles Barkley, Scottie Pippen Rockets. So, you know, it's a depressing thought. But, yeah, he had a lot of good times during that point. He is this is not the same Eddie Johnson that was arrested years later for the sexual assault of minor. That is fast Eddie Johnson, who played for primarily with the Hawks. This is the good Eddie Johnson. So just remember that. So
yeah, and there's a lot of controversy at the time as well. We won't spend a ton of time on this, but when the news of fast Eddie Johnson came out, a lot of news reports used this Eddie Johnson and this his career and his pictures and all that sort of stuff. And he had to say, "Hi, that's not me. That did that." To do a little bit of better research.
Not happy about that. Yeah.
Yeah. So he ended up, I forget exactly what happened, but I think he ended up saying, "You guys need to be a little bit more careful when you report this stuff, and maybe don't use my picture and say Eddie Johnson." You know, he's got family members calling him saying, "Eddie, what the hell's going on here?" So do better work, everybody, please.
Yeah.
All right, I'll talk about this one here. This is the Chicago Bulls. My Chicago Bulls. And in 1980, they said, all right, let's figure this out. What are we going to do here? We're going to sign Larry Keenan as a veteran free agent. We're going to send a 1981 second-round draft pick, eventually going to be Gene Banks, and a 1981 second-round pick, eventually going to be Ed Raines. We're going to send those to the San Antonio Spurs, and we're going to get things going here. And, Keenan, former All-Star. He had averaged 20.1 points per game and 9.9 rebounds per game the prior year in San Antonio. Kind of fell off a cliff with the Bulls. We'll talk about it in a bit, though. The Bulls, they were a good team at this point. They had won 45 games the year prior. They made it all the way to the conference semifinals. And Keenan was a big part of that, you know, when he comes into the team. Unfortunately, next year, the things start to go south. He only averages 7.2 points per game. The team starts to kind of fall into its malaise that it would be until Jordan came to town. He'd play 5 games for the Bulls in 1983, and then he'd eventually be waived. He'd finish out his career with 11 games on the Warriors, 32 games on the Cavaliers, before finally calling it quits. So Larry Keenan, good for a year, kind of got them, you know, helped them get to the Western Conference semifinals, but unfortunately, everybody on that team just started kind of get old all at the same time, and they ended up going in a different direction, and basically just being terrible for a while, having Reggie Theus and being terrible until Michael Jordan came to town. So that was that was their next strategy. Let's maybe have Reggie Theus or just be bad. I don't know. One. We'll try both.
Well,
how about that?
They both. Yeah.
Let's do a little bit of A, a little bit of B.
Yeah.
Let's see how it works out.
We could be bad with Reggie Theus. Yeah. Who knew?
Right. Anyway, Gene Banks, we mentioned him. He would play
Love Gene Banks, yeah.
Yeah. He played 4 relatively productive years for the Spurs before the Bulls said, hey, you know what? We made it wrong here in 1980. Yeah. We're going to get this on the right track. We are going to bring Gene Banks back into town. So
take it to the Banks. Yeah.
So 1985, he is traded by the San Antonio Spurs to the Chicago Bulls for Steve Johnson and a 1985 second round pick, Mike Britton. Unfortunately, they brought Gene Banks back in 1986 and 1987, and the Bulls at that time not really in the need for a 6'6", 6'7", shooting guard, small forward, combo guard at the time, as they had a pretty good one in Michael Jordan. So
hey, you can't have too many, you know.
Exactly. Well, they did apparently think that they had too many, because Gene Banks was eventually let go pretty quickly thereafter. He would go to Europe. He played there until 1993, actually. So good for him. He'd spend some years as assistant coach for the Washington Wizards. And now, Jason, this is not my opinion, and I don't know who wrote this. I don't know the source of this, but it was on his Wikipedia page, on Gene Banks' Wikipedia page. Okay.
All right.
So I mentioned he was an assistant coach for the Washington Wizards, okay?
Right.
Quote, he is credited with the development of such players as JaVale McGee, Andre Blatch, and Kevin Serafin.
Yeah, that is...
Don't know if I'd advertise that.
Well, one of those three is an Olympian, so... That's true. Yeah. Well, actually, two of those three. Was not Andre Blatch an Olympian for the Philippines? So.
Oh, you're right. Yeah, right.
So two Olympians. So that says something right there.
But I love that. The development of JaVale McGee, Andre Blatch, and Kevin Serafin. So thank you, Gene Banks, for giving us Kevin Serafin, I guess, and making him great. Hey. Oh, Kevin, I forgot Kevin Serafin. He may have coached three Olympians, because I forgot Kevin Serafin was from France.
Oh,
hold on. We got to find out if Kevin Serafin ever played in the Olympics, because then we're talking, man. We are talking about an all-time. Yes, he did. Man. All right. Let me apologize to Gene Banks.
Right, yeah.
Because my dude coached three Olympians, so.
Yeah.
Fantastic.
It was key in their development.
Yes. Right.
Yeah, let's not credit it. Yeah, he was credited for
it. There you go. Yeah. So as far as Ed Raines, I mentioned Ed Raines there. He played two seasons. He was not good, and I don't know anything else about Ed Raines. All right.
Yeah, that's fine. Not related to Tim Raines. So
there's only one Raines in the collective over and back hearts, and it's not Roman and it's not Ed. It's Tim Raines.
So. Absolutely. The Rock. So I think we're gonna put a pin in this here. We might dig into. Well, I guess we're gonna talk a little bit more. That's right. There are another basically 7 years where we talked about the rules change a bit. So they go to where it becomes more like modern restricted free agency, where instead of competition being automatic, basically a player can sign an offer sheet with a different team. And then, you know, the team can either choose to match it or they don't match it or they work out a sign and trade. So basically from 81 to 88, free agency gets pretty boring. I think the one thing that is particularly interesting, and I don't think we're going to go too deep into it because we've talked about it before, but 1982 offseason, by far the biggest transaction, during this period is incumbent MVP Moses Malone. Officially, Houston matches an offer sheet that he signed with the Sixers, but then they work out a sign and trade where the Sixers get Caldwell Jones and a 1983 first round draft pick that ends up being Rodney McRae. So, the Sixers also trade separately before this, traded Daryl Dawkins to the Nets for a first round pick that it was really just intended to clear salary so that they could, afford Moses Malone. This is right around the time where the salary cap becomes a factor. I think that actually comes into play in 83, but I think people knew it was coming. And, it was obviously, even if the salary cap isn't a direct factor, you still have to, maintain a decent payroll.
Right.
there are a lot of ins and outs toward that situation, but, we're running a little long here, but I wanted to mention that because if we're looking at the off seasons, after that, the biggest, probably the biggest free agency signing in 1983 might be Lewis Lloyd for the Rockets. 84 might be Pat Cummings or Elston Turner. 85, Ray Williams or Kyle Macy. 86, we got Orlando Woolridge. That's kind of a big deal.
Okay, he's a guy.
Frank Bukowski signing with the Lakers.
There we go. See, we said, we told you, we promised additional Frank Bukowski, and you got it.
Yeah, 1987, Tony Campbell, maybe, with the Bullets. Lester Connor, up until 88, which is finally, Tom Chambers is an unrestricted free agent. And then we've got, a number of decent names there. Walter Davis, Mike Woodson, Kurt Rambis, Tree Rollins, Orlando Woolridge, and aforementioned Moses Malone signing with the Hawks. So finally some names go there. But so the next few years, it's interesting because it was kind of considered a concession for the players to, get the get the offer sheets and the matching thing. That was kind of a meant to be an advancement in free agency, but it really, in practical terms, it basically stifled really very many interesting transactions outside of, of the Moses Malone situation.
Yeah, which a lot of times, when new things happen, especially with like player movement and free agency and that sort of stuff, there's a lot of just like, you would think it's like, oh, immediately everyone's going to jump on board, but there was a lot of just like, yeah, this is too complicated, or we don't want to give anything up, or it like you said, it led to a lot of people having cold feet about signing guys, and most people just not getting signed. So you led to Frank Brakowski being a highlight of an offseason. So that would be, sure. I mean, ESPN would go out of business if Frank Brakowski, you know what I mean? Like around the clock coverage. All right, guys, what are we hearing about Frank Brakowski? All right,
yeah. So, you know, huge.
Here's Woj on here to talk about Frank Brakowski.
Brakowski. Yeah, so, yeah. Yes.
All right. So what I'm hearing, guys, is that Brakowski's on his way to, you know, yeah, he's signed the offer sheet and now he's on his way. And what about Bill Willoughby? Tell us about Bill Willoughby. Like, you know.
Sham gets the
Bill Willoughby right. scoop
gets,
there.
Gets yeah. the yeah the Elston Turner yeah right. right yes the Jeff Lamp scoop you know for yeah like literally the 87 offseason there's four of them and they're all within like 2 weeks in October like that's the other thing like yeah. a lot of these like nothing happens until it, nothing all happens between the draft and like September October like you know there's literally no transactions of notes almost between that time you know it's So different
it's world. Not very exciting, yeah.
Right, exactly. So, Irish, well, I think we can close this one up.
I think we're good.
Yeah, cool. Well, thanks everyone for checking us out. You can find us at the Step Back at fansided.com. Lots of great NBA coverage here as, you know, we're starting to you know, get close to training camp and, you know, the new season coming aboard. You can always find good content there. Of course, you know, if you're into what we're doing, you appreciate a rating and review on any podcast platform that you use. And you can follow us on Twitter and Facebook at Over and Back. So thanks again for listening. We'll be back again soon.